Talk tonight about the second coming and the Antichrist. There's three sections on the second coming, and the first section focuses on the Antichrist. Last week we started this section, and then we took a little detour off into the appendix to talk about what it means a year, time and a half times, 1260 days, 42 months, 3.5 weeks, all that sort of thing. So that tonight's lesson will make some sense. So if you weren't here last week, sorry. At any rate, the Bible tells us that prior to the return of the Lord, there will be a seven-year period of tribulation.
Can you tell me about where you are?
Yes, we are on, I think it's page 36.
It's where we started last week.
Yeah.
The first 36
and
the second 36.
It's the
one that says the second coming of the Messiah.
Second coming of the Messiah. You weren't here last. Were you here when we did the?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you were here for
the
this.
Second 36.
Yeah, it'd be the second 36. See, I don't even know, because I just... All right, are we ready now? Sure. All right, we'll just give her back when you're done, and we'll be... So the Bible tells us that prior to the return of the Lord, there will be a seven-year period of tribulation upon the earth, culminating in the second coming of Christ. So we've already said a bunch right here. A seven-year period of tribulation on the earth, culminating in the second coming of Christ. That means that already I've taken the position that Jesus is coming back after the seven-year period. Okay, a world leader will emerge who captures the imagination of all nations. He is properly known as the Antichrist, but the Bible also calls him the Beast and the Man of Lawlessness. He exhibits signs and wonders and has a very persuasive tongue. He convinces Israel to trust him and is thought by many Jews to be the coming Messiah. He appears to bring long-sought-after peace to the Middle East and promise of worldwide tranquility. He rises to world dominance and the nations follow after him. Empowered by Satan, the dragon, who's referred to as the dragon in a lot of this apocalyptic literature, he exercises authority in both political and religious spheres and installs a religious leader to assist him. This second leader is known as the false prophet. For 3.5 years, the Antichrist seems to be fulfilling his promises toward Israel. But in the midst of the seven-year period, he breaks his covenant with Israel and brings intense persecution upon all Jews and believers. It is in response to the desperate and sincere prayers of the persecuted Jews that Jesus appears as their Messiah. Now, all of this that I have just given you is gleaned from the Scriptures. Some of it's not just gleaned from the Scriptures, some of it's just totally redundant in the Scriptures. But this is a summary that I'm going to use to lay a foundation for this, and we'll touch on the various aspects of it. Daniel 9:27 says, "He will make a firm covenant with many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week he will put a stop to the sacrifice and grain offering. On the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate, even until a complete destruction. One that is decreed is poured out upon the one who makes desolate." Now, there will be 1 week of Israel's time frame in which he will make a covenant with them. This is a seven-year period for reasons we talked about last year. And in the middle of that seven-year period, or in the middle of 3.5 years, he will break his covenant. And at that particular point in time, he will set up the abomination which makes desolate. Let's talk about a little bit of that for a minute. Imagine, if you would, that somebody could come along tomorrow, the next day, or whatever, and solve the Middle Eastern crisis. Solve it. Somebody come along with the perfect idea that made the Arabs happy, made the Jews happy, the wars stopped, they quit bombing each other, they were all happy, everybody got what they thought they wanted, and they were content to live side by side. Imagine such a thing would happen. How do you think the world would feel about that?
They'd like the guy a lot.
And they would also support the guy a lot. Yeah, whatever it is you need. Would you need a few UN troops or something to maintain all of this? That's fine. If you need some power under law, authority, that's fine too. We can work that out. If we need to dispense with a certain number of due processes, that's fine too. You know, whatever it takes for you to make this happen. Because, as we all have come to understand, in ways that we did not just a few years ago, the Middle East impacts us dramatically. The Middle East now causes us to stand in long lines at airports, have high prices for gasoline, be concerned at all times about what might happen at any particular moment in time anywhere on the face of the earth. anywhere in our world. It makes us suspicious of our neighbors. It causes us to have a lack of well-being that was not present before 9/11. It's not there. And so all of a sudden, we are now involved with the Middle East. Now, one of the things about this person is that he is going to set up the abomination which makes desolate. Now, the abomination which makes desolate is a term of art for an event. And the event specifically means that the setting up of an abomination in the temple that makes it desolate. That's what that meant to the Jews. Daniel is speaking here of an event that happens in 170 B.C. By a man named Antiochus Epiphanes, or Antiochus the Fourth. When Alexander died, his kingdom was split in four pieces based on the division of his four generals. And Cassander and Lysimachus had what is now Rome, Cassander and Rome, and what is now Bithynia and Thrace, and we don't worry about all those because they're not much in our story, biblical story. But Ptolemy took over what is now Egypt, and Seleucus took over what is now Syria, and that particular area. And right between Egypt and Syria is what? Palestine. And so what happened is in the yin and the yang between Ptolemy and Seleucus, Palestine became the football. Sound familiar? And so what happened is the Jews are constantly being bounced back and forth between these two powers as one of them ascends and the other one descends and then vice versa. Now, the reason why it's important to us, because it's important to Daniel, because Daniel views the whole world in terms of the Jews. Daniel is asking, in Daniel 9, he has asked the Lord to explain to him what is going to be the condition of the Jewish nation going forward for all time. And the Lord has told him that for 490 years, that God is going to have a relationship with them, and that at the end of 483 years, the Messiah is going to come and then be cut down. And then, at the end of the next 7 years, the Messiah is going to come and rule and reign and conquer. What Daniel doesn't know, what Paul tells us is there's a mystery hidden in the ages, and that is the Gentile church. That between the 483 years and the last 7 years is an entire age in which God no longer focuses on the Jews, but focuses instead on the Gentiles. So there's 490 years for the Jews, but they're just not all connected. It's kind of like any street in Atlanta. You know, it's you drive it along and then it stops, and you drive it along a little later and you pick it up again. The river chops it off, and the age of the Gentiles cuts into the time of the Jews. So in this period, during the time frame of Alexander from 333 all the way up to 67 B.C., we have this struggle between the Seleucids and the Ptolemaic Egyptians. The Seleucids, based in Syria and the nations sort of just north of them, have their rulers are named either Seleucus or Antiochus. The Ptolemaic kingdom, their rulers are named Ptolemy. In another time frame, their rulers are named Pharaoh. But in this particular case, they're named Ptolemy. So Antiochus IV is a deceitful man. He kills his nephew in order to get this particular job. He is a glib talker. He's a schemer. He does all kinds of things which are evil. He is a ruthless despot. He's like Richard the Longshanks, if you've read Braveheart. Yeah, another nice guy. And one of the things that he does is he struggles with Egypt constantly to take control over them. And it goes back and forth and back and forth. And during this long history, which is actually detailed for us in Daniel 11, which we can get to sometime, this long history, we see the emergence of a number of figures back and forth, including the original Laodicea, from which the town of Laodicea is named, the original Cleopatra, the various Ptolemies that were there, and then the Antiochuses. Antiochus IV, or Antiochus Epiphany, in the process of dealing with Egypt, wants a secure backyard. When he's in battle with Egypt, he wants to know that his rear flank is secure. And his rear flank is Palestine, the beautiful land. It's Israel. And so in order to make that so, he has to focus on establishing dominance in Palestine in order to have a good footing to do battle with Egypt. And they don't like him much. He brings in Hellenism. He comes into the Jewish world and he says, you guys need to get rid of all this Jewish hocus pocus and become Hellenist. You need to become Greeks. You need to become Greek in your thinking. We need to have games. We need to have gods. We need to have this. We need to have that. And many Greeks, many Jews follow him. A goodly number of Jews follow him. And so what happens is that he holds sway by politics and by because of his tongue, and also by power because of the force of his army. There are a certain number of people who don't follow him, who resist him. They are the fundamentalists. And they do exactly what the fundamentalists in the Palestine or in the Middle East are doing now. They hit and run, hit and run, hit and run, hit and run. And so they cause him a great deal of trouble. At one particular point in time, he hears that they had heard that he was killed in battle. And so what is it? Mark Twain said, the rumors of my death have been gradually exaggerated. And he hears that they like that, that they had a celebration in the streets. So he comes back to Jerusalem and he goes into the temple and he sets up a statue of Zeus and he proceeds to slaughter hogs in sacrifice to Zeus. That is the abomination which makes desolate. The setting up of the statue of Zeus and the slaughtering of these hogs to him desolates the temple. Now, it takes a while for the Jews to get him out of there. And when they finally get him out of there, they're trying to reestablish the temple, to reconsecrate the temple. And one of the things that happens to them is that they have to burn this anointed oil in the Holy of Holies, and they only have one vial, and they need more than that. It takes 8 days to consecrate a vial of this oil. And so they burn this vial of oil in the Holy of Holies, and it miraculously lasts for 8 days until they get the new stuff gone. That is the Feast of Hanukkah, the Feast of Lights. So what happens is that all of this stuff is wrapped up in Jewish history. They understood it well. They understood it well. So when Jesus says later about, and we're going to get to this tonight, when Jesus says, when you see the desolation, the abomination that makes desolate, in the future, when you see it again, then you will know that you got the Antichrist. Well, when he says that, he's pointing back to Daniel, to 170 B.C. He's pointing back to a time that they all know very well. Comments?
That was Antioch, King Antioch.
Antiochus, not King Antioch. Antiochus the Fourth, or Antiochus Epiphanes.
Antiochus.
Yeah.
Antiochus the Fourth.
Yeah. Or Antiochus Epiphanes. Yeah.
He was Greek.
No, he was not Greek. He was Syrian. He was Seleucid. He was one of Seleucus was one of Alexander's four generals, but it's his family line that forms the Syrian Empire. Antiochus Seleucus is in 330 B.C. Antiochus is in 170 B.C. It's 160 years between them.
Is he considered part of the Greek Empire?
No, the Greek Empire is over with as an empire once Alexander dies.
Still part of the Persian Empire?
No, Alexander defeats Persia. Alexander defeats Persia when he deals with Ahasuerus or Xerxes. And he defeats Persia, and Persia is still around, but it's in great decline. It's a fiefdom of Alexander's empire. Alexander's empire is the entire world. And he's 333 B.C. Now remember, the dates are going backwards, okay? When he dies, he conquers the world, gets involved in a 30-day drunken brawl, and dies in the middle of the party. He's got, and he's 30-some years old. He's 32 years old. I mean, he's just a kid. He's got a couple of little kids that basically get snuffed out pretty fast. And his four generals divide the kingdom among themselves. Now, it should be known that that world over there, which they knew as the world, has been divided into four about 50 times. Constantine, for instance, was one of those divisions, and his sons did the same thing. So there's a kind of a natural set of borders over there. Okay, so we okay now?
Yes.
All right. And when we study Daniel 11, for those of you who go through Daniel with us, we'll get into a great deal on this. And you who've got the book on Daniel 11 can go study chapter 11, the notes on that, and you'll get the whole, get all this. Okay. Now, the coming of this Antichrist was predicted with specificity as far back as the book of Daniel in chapters 7 and 8. This Antichrist is not a new concept for us today, nor was it new to Jesus, and certainly it wasn't new to the time of Daniel, because that's Daniel is 500 and something. 500. No, that's easy to do. Many have been skeptical about this apocalyptic writing and its connection to the eschaton, but among those who supported the idea are Jesus, Paul, and John the Revelator, and so I stick with those boys. I think they're my sources. Before we see what they had to say about Daniel's prophecies, let us first understand Daniel. Now, in the year of Belshazzar's reign, 553 BC, Daniel had a vision about four beasts, and Daniel provided the explanation about the historical explanation of these beasts in chapters 2 and 7 of his prophetic book. The first three beasts are Babylon, 1, Media-Persia, second beast, and Greece. The fourth beast represents the physical Roman Empire and its spiritual successors, the one world government of the eschaton. In other words, the Roman Empire, the spiritual successors to the Roman Empire is the one world government of the end times. Okay, we'll get there. Jesus evokes Daniel's image in his end time explanations, as does John in the book of Revelation. In fact, Jesus often refers to himself as the Son of Man, a messianic term in Daniel 7:13. Jesus did not call himself the Son of God. He only acknowledged it at one time. And that's because he knew the minute he said it, he'd be dead in 24 hours. And he was. Jesus acknowledged that he was indeed the Son of God when he was brought in handcuffs or in chains, whatever, bound to the Sanhedrin the night he was captured in the garden. And within 24 hours, he was dead. What Jesus did was he called himself the Son of Man. Now, the Son of Man is one of those kinds of terms that you could take it one of several ways. You could take it to mean that he was human. But you could also take it to mean, if it was capital S, capital N, that he was the Messiah. Because in Daniel 7:13, the Son of Man becomes the designated term for the Messiah. We've already studied in this course how the Messiah was predicted way back before all of that. We went as far back as Adam and Genesis 3, and we went through the prophets and the patriarchs and all that. But when we get to Daniel in 7:13, the term Son of Man emerges as a term to describe the Messiah. And Jesus referred to himself as the Son of Man. He says, when you see the Son of Man, the Son of Man, it falls upon the Son of Man. He talks about the Son of Man. He uses that term all the time. He can get away with that because he's got plausible deniability. He doesn't have to worry about it. Now, the same thing is generating the reason why we're studying these books that are written in a form called apocalyptic. Apocalyptic, the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation, are written apocalyptic. Zechariah is apocalyptic, and Animal Farm was apocalyptic. Gulliver's Travels was apocalyptic. The writing form, apocalyptic, is written by people who want to make a statement in the face of a hostile government who has the power to kill them. And so they write in a code or a parable or a fantasy using terms to describe certain peoples and events and things, which terms are easily understood by the people who read it, but not easily understood by the enemy. Okay? So, you know, if you're trying to write about the idiocy of the ruling powers of Europe, so you write Gulliver's Travels about people who are big-headed and people who are small and all kinds of stuff. But that keeps you from getting killed, because if you say that the Habsburgs are a bunch of idiots, you won't last as long as Salman Rushdie. So the point is that you write in code, or you write in fantasy, you write in allegory. That's what apocalyptic is. John is sitting on the Isle of Patmos. He has been exiled there for being a Christian leader. He's writing letters to his seven churches. He is trying to share some things with them. And one of the things he's trying to share with them is that the present persecution is nothing to be overly concerned about. It will not last, and it certainly won't stand eternally. It's nothing they need to be concerned about. Worst thing that can happen is they'll die, but Jesus is going to win. And so the entire book of Revelation is written in apocalyptic form, in code, as it were, to these people, and the code and words that he uses are easily understood by them, but not so easily understood by us because we haven't finished them, and not understood at all by the Romans. Otherwise, he would be dead because he is accusing the Roman Caesars of being godless men and not the king, but Christ is the king and all that sort of thing. So at any rate, he writes in the form of apocalyptic. Now, I've said this before. Let's say that we were overtaken by an alien nation. Did it come? And here we are. We're all subservient down here. And let's say that we're actively working underground to try to get rid of them, but it ain't easy because they're powerful. And so what happens is you're with some friends in a cafe or something, you're sitting around talking, and you're trying to have a discussion about last night's raid. You know, and so you go, how did it go? He said, well, we hit a triple, but we didn't get the home run. Okay. Well, you know, the waiter who's going by, who's got antenna coming out of his ears and all that kind of stuff, he thinks you're talking baseball. Mm-hmm. He thinks you're talking baseball because to him, that's all that can mean. Triples and home runs. That's all it can mean. Okay. Oh, these guys were out playing baseball last night. But you're not. You're saying we got three-fourths of what we wanted to get done in the raid last night, but we didn't get it all. You see? Simple example. And there would be millions of them. We as a people, nation, species, locality, regional locality, have terms, you know, like, what's fixing mean? You know, like I'm fixing to go here. Well, what's that mean? You know? So the point is that we have terms that make sense to us, but don't make sense to other people around them. And when we speak in that dialect, or that code, then other people can't hear what's going on. And that's kind of what's happening here in the book of Daniel, who is writing in the middle of a Babylonian kingdom, speaking of the overthrow of it. And in the case book of Revelation, who is writing in the middle of a Roman kingdom, speaking of the overthrow of it. One of the reasons why we study the eschaton is to develop some background understanding of what these terms mean, so that when we study the book of Daniel, we study the book of Revelation, they make some sense to us. It won't take as long. Now, Daniel 7, 1 through 6. In the first year of Belshazzar, the king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions in his mind as he lay on his bed, and he wrote the dream down and he related the following summary of it. Daniel said, I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts were coming up from the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had the wings of an eagle. Which is Babylon. I kept looking until its wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. A human mind was also given to it. So we have this beast that has this particular shape and form, like a lion, had the wings of an eagle. In Ezekiel 1:1 through 14, Babylon is described the same way. That is actually the symbol of Babylon. One of the things about Daniel that's nice is that when Daniel uses these terms, he later defines them. So we don't have to guess what Daniel means by most of his terms. He later can define them in sort of off to the side. Now, the second beast we're here. Behold, another beast, the second one, resembling a bear. This is Media Persia. And it raised up on one side, and three ribs were in its mouth between his teeth. And thus they said to it, arise, devour, and eat much meat. After this I kept looking, behold, another one like a leopard, which is Greece, which had on its back four wings of a bird. This beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. So you have the Media Persia with its three forms, the two Medes and the Persian. The Medes and the Persians were interrelated family. They were related by blood. And this was a case where the Medes, who were actually the far more sophisticated of the communities, sort of fairly quickly got overtaken by the people who came behind them, who were far less sophisticated but much more ruthless. So, yeah.
So Daniel's writing around 500 B.C. Mm-hmm. So is this more of him as a prophecy?
Yeah, absolutely. Daniel, the first six chapters of Daniel are all about Bible stories designed to show that you can trust God. The Daniel in the lion's den, the three children in the fiery furnace, the story that starts off about them eating the good foods and not eating the good foods, you know, all the stuff. All the first six chapters are stories about Daniel's life, he and his three buddies, Meshach, Yerushak, and Winnebago, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These four young men carried off into captivity, made eunuchs, You can explain that to your wives later. Made eunuchs and then brought up in the house of the young wise men of Babylon, trained and educated, whatever. And in that place, they trusted God. And God met them. And the first six chapters of Daniel are all about that. We see Daniel, for instance, rising to great heights of power. Daniel becoming the second in all of the kingdom over all of Persia. Daniel protecting Nebuchadnezzar's Babylonian throne when Nebuchadnezzar goes nuts and starts wandering around the year for a year eating grass like an ox in the field. Same thing that happened to King George III, the madness of King George, that kind of thing. So we have the first six chapters are telling us we can trust God. And then we get the next chapters to come behind and they tell us about the end time. That's what they tell us. And the end time chapters are all prophetic. Daniel has two great spheres of vision. He can see the near long term and the long term. So he prophesies in detail what happens to the Israeli people. Well, first of all, he prophesies what happens to them immediately after their captivity. Then he prophesies what happens to them in the 170 BC area, and then he prophesies what happens to them at the end of time. So he gets all three spheres in the reach of his prophetic ministry.
And the
170 BC being where the Seleucids were conquering, and where Antiochus Epiphanes came from, and all that thing, where the first Antichrist or where the person who the Antichrist is referred to actually emerges. Okay.
So, at this time, Persia, what is today Iran?
Yes.
Okay.
Babylon was what is today Iraq.
Okay. And where did the Kurds come?
Oh gosh, you're.
Country?
Well, they're all part. These are all tribes. These are all different tribal groups, but the Kurds live in Iraq and they live in Iran both. Yeah. Huh? Yeah, in Turkey. That's right. Yeah.
And probably Afghanistan today. But where did they start?
I have no idea. I mean, I don't. I'm not knowledgeable about the Kurds in particular. Okay. But they're just subsets of these same nations. They're really cultural and religious groups within them. And that's kind of like saying they're Baptists when everybody else is Presbyterian. Or they're Northerners when everybody else is Southerners. You know, that kind of thing. All right, so we have these three beasts, four beasts that he gets his vision of. But he's telling us about the first three. And the first one that comes forth is, of course, Babylon. In his vision, the second beast that comes out of the sea, and the sea is often used in prophetic language to mean the peoples, out of the sea of people. We talk about a sea of people. In the book of Revelation, it talks about the fact that the Lord sits on his throne and at his feet is a great sea, and it means the sea of peoples. And so out of the sea of peoples, out of humanity, comes forth these four nations, these four beasts. So with Babylon being first, the Medes and the Persians coming along next, and then Alexander and the Greeks and their his successors after that. Now in Revelation 13:1-5, going forward now to the book of Revelation, it says, "And he stood on the sand of the seashore, and I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads, and on his horns were 10 diadems, and on his heads were blasphemous names. And the beast which I saw was like a leopard, and his feet were like those of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion." Okay, so this beast that is the Antichrist that comes forward over time has genetic material coming forth from the leopard, the bear, and the lion, which is kind of where we're at here. And when John says that, they get it. They get it. The dragon, you know, it's kind of like today. If someone wrote something and they said, and the usurper came forward, and on his staff he carried a cross and a sickle and a hammer. Who would it be?
Russia.
That's right. Because we know that symbol, and they know very well who the winged lion is. They know full well who the bear is. They know full well who the leopard is. They've seen the flags in the armies. They've seen the stuff go by. They've seen, if you go to their temples today, which still stand, you see the winged lions on the remains of the Iranian, of the Babylonian temples in Iraq and the area, and you see all this stuff. Okay, so he said it has like this, And the dragon gave him his power and his throne and great authority. The dragon is Satan in the book of Revelation. And I saw one of his heads as if it had been slain. His fatal wound was healed. The whole earth was amazed, and they followed after the beast, and they worshipped the dragon because he gave his authority to the beast. And they worshipped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast, and who is able to wage war with him?" Excuse me. So, we see that in the book of Revelations already that John is using the language we just learned about in Daniel here, talking about the Antichrist. Remember, tonight's topic is the Antichrist. Okay, so he is describing in the book of Revelation, in the cryptic form that the book of Revelation is written in, the emergence of the Antichrist. And we're told he has the genetic material of the lion, the bear, and the leopard. And that, you know, that he, all this kind of stuff. And that he is a beast. He's a beast. Say, they know what a beast is because they've read Daniel and other places. After this, Daniel says, going back to Daniel now, after this, because I quit before with Daniel in verse 6, now I'm going back to 7. After this, I kept looking in the night visions. Behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying, extremely strong, and had large iron teeth. And it devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet, and it was different from all the other beasts before it, and it had 10 horns. While I was contemplating the horns, behold, another one, a little one, came up among them, and 3 of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it. Behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man, and mouth uttering great boast. Okay? Now, Daniel says that there was a fourth beast in his vision. And this beast was different than the other ones. He was larger, more widespread, more despotic, more crushing. And let's read it again a little bit more slowly. He was terrifying, extreme, and he had large iron teeth. The beast, as it's described here, is made of iron. It's devoured and crushed and trampled under the remainder of his feet. It was different from all of this. It had 10 horns. Now, the reason why Rome is thought of as the 10-horned beast is because it emerges out of 10 people groups. There are 10 people groups that make up what is the Roman Empire. And so there is actually all kinds of historical information that's embedded in here. And when John gets to using this, he's talking about stuff that happened already. Daniel's using it to talk about stuff that will. But he goes on to say, while I was contemplating the horns, and horns is always a biblical symbol for power. A person with many horns has power. While I was contemplating the horns, behold, another one, a little one, came up among them, and 3 of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it. And this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man and mouth uttering great boast. That's the Antichrist emerging out of this fourth beast. Okay. Now, if you go back to what he says in Revelation 13, he said, I saw one of his heads as if it had been slain, fatal wound. That's not what I wanted here. Yeah, all right. Well, he said this beast had 10 horns and 7 heads, and on his horns were 10 diadems or crowns, and his heads were blasphemous names. So the emergence of someone out of the middle of this who kills 3 of the leaders reduces it to 7 heads. So there's a, you know, this is like mud on the wall. I just wanted to show you the correlation there for now. We'll get to more of it later. Daniel 7:9. I looked. He kept on looking. So he is looking at the history of Israel, what's going to happen. And he says, I looked until thrones were set up. So I kept looking. I was looking at what was going on. I saw this first beast that came up, Babylon. And then I saw after another beast, Persia and Media. And then another beast after that, the Greeks of Alexander. And then a fourth beast, more powerful, feet of iron, Rome. And then we're going to see later on that there is another Rome down the road. So I saw these beasts. And then I kept looking until thrones were set up. And the Ancient of Days took his seat, and his vesture was like white snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. Okay? So I was looking at what was happening, and in the natural progression of these beasts coming forth, I saw a thrones set up, and the ancient one like the Ancient of Days, God sat on it. That's a term for God. God sat on the throne. And it says here, his vesture was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. Now, one of the things we run into in the book of Revelation is is that Jesus is described as having hair of pure wool. Now, if you don't understand where that comes from, you're going, why? You know, what's going on? His throne was ablaze with flames. Its wheels were like burning fire. A river of fire was flowing, coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands were attending him, and myriads upon myriads standing before him, looking at the host of heaven, the angels around God. And the court sat, and the books were opened. So, and there's going to be a reckoning in the end, he said. After the four beasts and their successors come forth and do what they're going to do on the earth. And trample Israel underfoot and do those kinds of things. Then there's going to be a reckoning. Thrones will be set. God will come forth. All of his men, his people, his myriads of angels and whatever will attend him. And he will set and do judgments. That's why thrones are set. Then Daniel 7:11. Then I kept looking because the sound of the boastful words which the horn was speaking. So this horn, this one that was, this horn, the one that emerged out of the other ones, the Antichrist, was speaking boastful words. And one of the things we're going to see about the nature of the Antichrist throughout the story is that he speaks boastful words. He's bragging, he's cocky, he's arrogant, he does all kinds of things. We'll see it over and over and over again. And it was speaking... And I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body was destroyed and given to the burning fire. So he said, I kept watching, and eventually this beast, this Antichrist, he was slain, his body destroyed, and it was given to the burning fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but an extension of life was granted to them for an appointed period of time. I kept on looking in the night visions, and behold, with clouds of heaven, one like the Son of Man was coming. Now, this is Daniel 7:13. This is the place where the term Son of Man begins to be used for the Antichrist. One like the Son of Man was coming, and he came up to the Ancient of Days, that's God, and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and kingdom, that all the nations and peoples and men of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which will not pass away. His kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. Okay? So when this whole process occurs, that this Antichrist is cast down, broken, defeated, and cast into the lake of fire, then one like the Son of Man emerges, and a kingdom is given to him. So, Israel, these are the kingdoms that are going to affect you between now and the end, okay, until your Messiah comes. There's this Babylonian kingdom, there's this Media-Persian kingdom, there's this Greek kingdom, and then there's this Roman kingdom, and we'll get to this in a little bit later, but there's another emergence of the Roman kingdom later. And during that particular emergence of the Roman kingdom, which we'll get in other scriptures, all this other stuff is going to happen. He's going to rise up. He's going to trample down the people. He's going to boast. He's going to brag. He's going to do this kind of stuff. He's going to come to power by deceit. He's going to kill three in order to take their place and rule over everybody else. He's going to do all these kinds of things until a throne is set up and judgment is brought upon him. And when that happens, then one like the Son of Man is going to come forward, and he's going to be given a kingdom. Now, his kingdom is a kingdom in which there is no end. His kingdom is one which will not pass away. His dominion is everlasting dominion. So we haven't seen this kingdom yet. By definition, this kingdom has not yet come. This is the kingdom of Christ. Now, the thing about it is that Christ can't be a king on the earth unless he's king on the earth. If we have a scenario where some people would suggest that once Jesus comes back, we all go to heaven, then we don't have a kingdom on the earth. One of the things that we'll see when we get to talking about the millennial reign later is that there's a whole foundation in the scriptures that tells us that there's going to be a kingdom of Christ on the earth. How many here know who Georgia O'Keeffe is? She's a painter, and she paints in a theme called the Peaceable Kingdom. She has dozens of paintings called the Peaceable Kingdom. And she paints pictures of lions and lambs laying down together and all that sort of thing. There has been, throughout human history, an understanding that the garden was a peaceable kingdom and that it will return again, that we'll go back to the garden, and that in the same way that the garden was ruled by man, so will the garden be ruled by man again. It is the foundational understanding of utopia. It is where we get the notion that we will one day again live in peace. And people will beat their swords into plowshares, and the lion will then now with the lamb. The child will play in the adder's den, and the straw will eat straw. The lion will eat ox like the straw, etc. Straw like the ox. All that sort of thing. So the notion of a peaceable kingdom, a kingdom on the earth in time, in which Christ reigns and rules, is rooted throughout the Bible, all the way back into human history, for what that's worth for now. Yes.
In that paragraph you were reading, he was talking about the Antichrist getting thrown into the lake of fire.
Yeah.
He also talks about the rest of the beasts. Were they just other Antichrists?
The rest of the kings. The rest of the kings, not the rest of the beasts. The rest of the kings. Yeah, but he means beast means rulers or kings. What that tells you is that there will be survivors on the earth of the people who follow the Antichrist, and that their time will be extended for a period of time. So there are people whose notion of what happens at the second coming is total annihilation of the earth. Annihilation of the earth, all of its people, everything's gone, burns up like a cinder, and we all go to heaven. That's a notion that emerges out of the atomic understanding. It's not a notion that was even thought possible or even considered before that time frame. The notion of total annihilation of the earth and all its people is only as old as the atomic age. As the pre-atomic age. In other words, some of these constructs that we think of today as being just what must be, because everybody talks about them, are only go back to the late 1800s or early 1900s. Up until 6,000 years of recorded history before that time frame, that was not how they were thought about, taught, what the Bible says, or any of those kinds of things. So what the Bible points out to throughout is that after the defeat of the Antichrist, there will be people left on the earth. They will live in a human format. They will not be followers of Christ. They will be the remnant of the people on the earth who were there when Jesus came back. They will be greatly reduced by the cataclysm that happens at the time of Christ. There's many a movie about this, right? There's been a nuclear holocaust, and there's this nuclear winter, they call it. A few people left here and there, whatever. It's a great theme among us. What do you do? Starting over. So when we get to the millennial reign and all that sort of thing, we'll develop this more thoroughly using the scriptures. But that's what that's referring to. The other kings who followed after him, many of them will continue on after he is gone. Now, we can get into some more of this. If you want to go to the notes on Daniel Revelation for the beast, you can get more of it there. But let me move on. Daniel 7:26, the court will sit for judgment, his dominion will be taken away, annihilated and destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty, the dominion, the greatness of all the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be given to the people of the saints of the highest one. So who will be given the dominion of the earth? The people of the saints, or the people of the descendants of Christ. And in this particular case, he means that to mean Israel. Because remember, Daniel doesn't see the Gentiles. All he sees is Israel. And his kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all the dominions will serve and obey him. All of the prophets have spoken to the fact that the king of the earth and the messianic king will be the kingdom over all nations, not just Israel. They will talk about nations coming up and honoring him, honoring Israel because they are the people of the king. And in Isaiah, he prophesies the restoration of Egypt. He prophesies the restoration of many of the Middle Eastern countries. So the understanding is that at the time of the end, the Jews are going to have a preeminence because they are the children of the king, who is the king over the earth. We talked about that in the earlier part of the study where we talked about the preeminence of Israel, how it is a constant theme throughout the scriptures. Daniel 8:22, the broken horn and the four horns that arose in its place represent four kingdoms which arise from his nation, although not with his power. All right, now who is the broken horn and the four horns who arose in his place? You can get this by now. Who is this? Who is the broken horn or the broken power, and there are four powers that arose in his place? That'd be Alexander. That's exactly right. So and it says here, these four kingdoms will rise from his nation, but not with his power. They won't have his strength. And in the latter period of their rule, when the transgressors have run their course, a king will arise, insolent and skilled in intrigue. So in the latter period of these four rulers, when they are when their history is running its course, this king is going to arise among them who is insolent and skilled in intrigue. His power be mighty, but not by his own power. And he will destroy to an extraordinary degree and prosper and perform his will. He will destroy mighty men and holy people. And through his shrewdness, he will cause deceit to succeed by his influence. He will magnify himself in his heart. He will destroy many while they are at ease. He will even oppose the prince of princes. But he will be broken without human agency. And the vision of the evenings and the mornings, which has been told, is true. But keep the vision secret, for it pertains to many days in the future. Okay? So what Daniel is saying is that there's going to emerge from this group of people, these four kingdoms that emerged out of Alexander, in the latter days of their particular run, this particularly deceptive, cruel, bitter, despotic man who by intrigue and skill of intrigue comes to power, not by right, not even by might, but because he's a deceiver. And that he is going to have extraordinary power, influence, the ability to persuade. He's going to be a silver-tongued devil, as they would say. And he will oppose the prince of princes. Okay. Now, if you are a person who opposes the Christ, what does that make you? Antichrist. Okay. So this guy who's going to come forth, he is going to be anti the Christ, the Anointed One. The word Christos is a Greek word, which is the equivalent of the Hebrew word HaMashiach. HaMashiach is where we get the word Messiah. And the word itself means the Anointed One. The Anointed One. That's all it means. Okay.
Two translations in people's way of thinking. I mean, I would prefer that it not be possible. But is it possible that the Antichrist could be a woman?
I don't know why it couldn't be. I'd have to think that through. Could be. Hell have no fear, you know. Could be. Would you like that?
No, I am not. I just wondered.
Yeah.
Believe me, I am not.
Yeah, there's a... you have to remember that biblical language is... The biblical language is by and large patriarchal. It's interesting, but in the Bible... The Hebrews are told that when God is displeased with you, when you have deserted Him at the highest levels, and He is really displeased with you, He will cause you to be ruled by women and boys.
So she meant it.
When God is displeased with you, and He's really upset with you, and He's done everything else He can to reach you, that part of your degradation is you'll be ruled by women and boys. Now remember, it's patriarchal language. That kind of insult would have been very insulting. For instance, in the book of Judges, Deborah, who leads Israel to victory, emerges because she's a prophetess. And there was a man whose name was Barak, who God came to and said, I want you to lead Israel to victory. Deborah came to him and she said, God has called you to lead Israel to victory. And he said, I'll go, but only if you go at our head. Only if you go at our head. And she said, I'll go at your head. But because of your lack of faith, the victory will not come to a man. It will fall to a woman. And so we see that Sisera, the leader of the Canaanites, who was killed by a woman. He was running and hiding from the battle. He was exhausted. He came to her house thinking that she would be a friend. He fell asleep under a rug where she was trying to hide him, and she drove a tent peg through his head with a mallet, which gives you quite a headache. Yes.
I have a question about this one here in Daniel 8:22-26. If that's the rise of the Antichrist.
Daniel 8:22. Yes, that's the rise of an Antichrist. Not the end-time Antichrist, but an Antichrist.
But if who was this back here that was with the boasting tongue then?
It's the same person. Yeah, what you have to one of the things we'll, if you ever get to the book of Revelation, one of the things that we're going to see is that the book of Revelation and many of these prophetic works are written like describing the elephant. And this is what gets a lot of people in trouble, because we tend to read it linear, like, okay, this happened and then this happened and this, oh wait a minute, didn't that already happen? And what happens in the book of Revelation, starting about chapter 9, is it starts going around the elephant. It's sort of like this meanwhile back at the ranch thing. Okay. Meanwhile, back at the ranch. Some of y'all remember that? Meanwhile, back at the ranch. What happens is John, in the book of Revelation, he gets describing an event. And then he comes over here and he describes the same time frame with an, and then the same time frame. And all of them end with the emergence of the Messiah. And so if you read it linear, it's kind of like, and then the Messiah came, and then another Messiah came, and then another Messiah came. So one of the things that happens, you have to remember, we're reading, we're not reading Western, postmodern or modernistic technical journals here. We're reading ancient Near Eastern literature, by and large. We're reading stuff that's different than what we're used to. So one of the secrets to understanding this is to recognize that they keep circling around the same event, telling you the same story from different sides. If you read it linear, you're going to get into trouble. I know, because I did for like 15 years. Drove me crazy. All right, where am I? Okay, so he said, now this this Antichrist who comes up against the Prince of Princes, he'll be broken without human agency, blah, blah, blah. And the vision of the evenings and morning, which has been told, is true. And we'll get into the visions of the evening and morning later. Well, not right now. But keep this a secret. Vision is a secret because it pertains for many days in the future. Now, more important to us than the coordination between Daniel and Revelation are the words of Jesus himself. I mean, I can sit here and say, this is Revelation, and this is Daniel, and this means this. See it? See it? Don't pay attention to the man behind the curtain. See this? I can do that. And you might buy it or you might not buy it. But what I buy, because I got tired of all this too, is I buy what Jesus says. I use what Jesus and John and Paul say as the thing that I, as my rudder, to try to figure out where things are. Because I figured they knew what they were talking about. So in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Jesus has this to say about what we just read. As Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, tell us when these things will be and what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age. He just told them, for instance, that the temple stones are going to be torn down, not one stone be left upon another, etc., etc., etc. And Jesus answered them and said, see to it that no one misleads you, for many will come in my name saying, I am the Christ, and will mislead many. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. You will see that you are not frightened, for those things must take place, but that is not yet the end. For nation will rise against nation, kingdoms against kingdom. In various places there will be famines and earthquakes, but all of these things are merely the beginning of birth pangs. Then they will deliver you to tribulation and will kill you, and you will be hated by all the nations on account of my name. At that time, many will fall away and deliver up one another and hate one another. And many false prophets will arise and will mislead many. And because lawlessness is increased, most people's love will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached to the whole world for a witness to all the nations, and then the end shall come. Now, Jesus is talking about when is Jerusalem going to be torn down and all these kinds of things. And he is telling them about something that's going to happen in 70 A.D. If we've seen 66 and 70 A.D., Titus, the Roman general, son of Vespasian, comes to Israel, Jerusalem, and throws up a siege engine all around it. And takes 4 years to conquer the city. 4 very difficult years. Now, you have to remember that soldiers are paid by the booty. Soldiers are not paid by coins and stuff like that. They don't get a regular salary. They're paid by the booty. In fact, they eat what they can find. If you read Caesar's Gallic Wars in the Latin, which we had to when we were kids, I'm sure you all read Caesar's Gallic Wars in Latin. If you studied Latin in high school, you read Caesar's Gallic Wars in Latin. But one of the things, for instance, that you get in there is you get a description of soldiers eating dinner. Okay, and one of the things that you're told is that on those times when the provender is plentiful, that the cooks go and they make these plates out of crust, and they put the provender on it, and everybody eats off of the plates. But it says when the provender is not so plentiful, they eat the plates too. That's the first reference in history to pizza. It's just the dough plate. Don't laugh at me. It's the dough plate that the provender was eating on, but in bad times, they ate the plate too. Caesar's Gallic Wars. It's written in Latin. It's got to be true.
I think Kelvin Robinson was going to kill
her. Yeah, that's right. That's right. So, anyway, so it's a very bad siege, very, very difficult. And since the soldiers are not getting paid in 4 years' time, and the provender is getting thinner and thinner, when they finally break in, they are mad. They're mad. And so they, one of the reasons, one of the ways that Titus keeps them focused on the siege so that they don't go home and leave and whatever, is to tell them that the streets of Jerusalem are paved with gold, and that the temple is made out of pure gold, and that when they tear it down, they're going to have just lots of gold. And so when they break in, they don't find near as much gold as they expect to find, and they set the temple on fire because there is gold plating on the walls, some of the walls of the temple. They set it on fire to get the gold to run so they can collect it and whatever. And they tear it down, stone upon stone, because they're trying to get to the gold. Surely under here somewhere, you know, it's like the kid who gets a room full of straw for Christmas. If he's an optimist, he says, got to be a pony in here somewhere, right? So surely there's got to be something in there. And so, yeah, that's right. At any rate, Jesus says, this is going to happen to you. There's going to be all these things that are going to happen, and people are going to turn you in. It's going to get bad. It's going to get tough. It's going to get difficult. Now, historically speaking, the apostles were not supposed to be in Jerusalem at this time, but they were at the beginning. They were still there in 66, and by that time, when things got tough, they began to slip out of town and go out and do what Jesus told them to do, which was go out and be my disciples to Judea, Samaria, Galilee, and the ends of the earth. So 30 years later, they got around to doing that. But it took that to make it happen. Titus, after he conquered that, went over to the last Jewish stronghold, Masada, and he conquered it. Once again, took him years and years and years to do it, but he did, and then he became emperor for about 2 years and then died. All right, now therefore, verse 15, continuing on, but continuing on and not continuing on. Therefore, when you see the abomination which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to get the things that are in his house. And let him who is in the field not turn back to get his cloak. But woe to those who are with child, woe to those who are nurse babes in those days. Pray that your flight may not be in the winter or on a Sabbath, for then there will be a great tribulation, that should say, in there, such as has not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever shall. Unless those days have been cut short, no life would have been saved. For the sake of the elect, those days shall be cut short. Then if anyone says to you, behold, here is the Christ, there he is, do not believe him, for false Christ and false prophets will arise and show great signs and wonders so as to mislead as possible even the elect. Behold, I have told you in advance. If therefore they say to you, behold, he is in the wilderness, do not go forth. Behold, he is in the rooms, do not go forth. For just as the lightning comes from the east and flashes even to the west, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. In other words, where the bodies pile up, that's where you're going to see the vultures gather. Now, we're going to stop here for just a minute. All prophecy has layers of interpretation. And one of the reasons that makes it true prophecy is this, that it has layers of interpretation. It is fulfilled in part down through history, and sometimes fulfilled many times down through history. But it has an ultimate fulfillment at the end. And that's this part of the nature of prophecy. So, for instance, when Hezekiah was born, Hezekiah, in 742, Isaiah was a member of the royal family, and it was the year that King Uzziah died. And it was that particular point in time that Isaiah began to see the Lord. We see the Lord, he's high and lifted up, and his train fills the temple, and the angels cry holy. It was in the year that King Uzziah died. Uzziah had a son and then a grandson. His grandson's name was Ahaz. Ahaz was a wicked king. But Ahaz had a son whose name was Hezekiah. And Hezekiah was given over to Isaiah for Isaiah to be his mentor and tutor. This was a young Isaiah at this particular point in time. And Isaiah taught Ahaz about the Lord. So that by the time that we get to Ahaz running Israel or Judah, as it is. He does a good job. He's a good king. And because of it, certain things happen in history that we're familiar with that wouldn't have happened because of Ahaz. And so we get this thing. Now, when Ahaz is born, there is an euangelion that is recorded. An euangelion. Euangelion, it's where we get the word evangelism. An euangelion is a message of great joy, a message of great tidings. And euangelions are given when the son of a king is born or a great battle is won. That's what an euangelion is. And if you read euangelion, it's E-U, angelion. Or if you use a V, it's evangelism or evangelical. Okay, so we get the word now because the U becomes a V. But at any rate, when Hezekiah is born, the euangelion comes forth and says, "Unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and he shall be called Wonderful Counselor and Mighty God and all this and this and this and this." You've heard this before, right? Well, this particular euangelion was given concerning Hezekiah. That he was born, including the part about him being a mighty God and all this kind of stuff. Because one of the things about euangelions is they're full of hyperbole. If you saw the movie The Ten Commandments, you remember that priest of On was making all these pronouncements about Seti as he was dying. Oh, the great falcon is flying too, and he's all this kind of stuff. And Seti says, the old windbag, you know. Seti was smart enough to realize that none of what he was saying was true. But it was what you do with kings. You know, you talk about them and whatever. So the words, "Unto us a son is born, unto us a child is given," were fulfilled in Hezekiah. But they were meant for Jesus. Okay? When David gets to talking about certain things that are happening, like it's various things in the scriptures, he has an actual event in mind. But the reason it's prophetic is because it also speaks to another event later. You see what I'm saying? Prophecy has layers of fulfillment. It wouldn't make any sense if it didn't have any near-term meaning. Some of these things just they wouldn't have lasted. Nobody would have recorded them if they had any near-term meaning. But they have real meaning because they have near-term meaning, but they also have far-term meaning as well. So Jesus is sitting here talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, and then he vamps into what's going to happen in the ultimate, in terms of the persecution of the people concerning the fall of Jerusalem. Because Jesus can see the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. He can also see the fall of Jerusalem at the end time. He's seeing them both at the same time. And we know this from context. I'll get to that in just a minute. Now, he says here, up until verse 14, he's talking about stuff that can be clearly satisfied by the events of 70 AD. But then he starts talking about stuff that can't. He says, "Therefore, when you see the abomination and desolation, which is spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand." That's an aside in which he's basically saying to them, you know what I mean. Okay, when you see that, you know what I mean. "Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Those who are in the housetop not go down. But let them in his field not turn back to his cloak. What are those who are with child? Those who nurse babes, who pray their flight maybe on the winter and a Sabbath. It'd be a great tribulation, such as not occurred since the beginning of the world, nor shall ever be again." So one of the things that we begin to see is he's talking about a time in which a number of things are happening. First of all, there's a Sabbath observance. Otherwise, why would it be difficult for it to happen on the Sabbath? Secondly, it's a time in which a tribulation is going to arise. It's going to be the worst that ever was and ever will be again. And by definition, we haven't seen that yet. Because the one that's coming is worse than any that will ever come. And after that tribulation, there will never be another one. So we realize we're talking about the end time. It will be a great tribulation such as... in verse 21 there, the word tribulation after the word great just doesn't get printed. It should say tribute, such as has not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever shall. And unless those days had been cut short, no life would have been saved, but for the sake of the elect, they shall be cut short. Now, you see, he's talking now about something that's happening in the future, saying that those days, if they hadn't been cut short, even the elect would have been destroyed. But for the sake of the elect, they get cut short. And when he says the elect, he's meaning Israel here. For those, if anyone says you behold, there is the Christ, blah, 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 the false Christ, false prophets, even people showing signs and wonders, don't pay attention to those people. Now, why would he say that there's going to be false Christ showing signs and wonders? Well, because we're told that the Antichrist is going to show signs and wonders, that he's a false Christ. That's what Jesus called him. So they're going to mislead you. And if possible, they would even mislead the elect. If it were possible, if the elect did not have spiritual discernment, they would be misled too. Behold, I have told you this in advance. He said, I'm telling you this in advance. If they say to you, behold, he is in the wilderness, do not go forth. If he says he's in the room, do not believe him. So if someone says the Messiah has come, he's living in New York, we should go up and see him, which is what the Jehovah's Witnesses believe. Or if someone says the Messiah has already come all this has happened, he says, don't believe it. You know why? Because he says, the Son of Man, when he comes, will come like lightning comes from the east. Like the east, and flashes even to the west, so shall be the coming of the Son of Man. In other words, it'll be seen by everybody clearly when he comes. From one end of the sky to the other, they will see the coming of the Son of Man. It won't be a secret. It won't be special knowledge. It won't be hidden. It won't be for a small group of people. Everybody's going to know, Jesus said. And wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. What he is trying to say is that if you're in a battlefield and there's just a bunch of bodies laying all over the place, the vultures gather. There's wherever there's death, the vultures gather. Okay, so he's saying that the time of the coming of the Son of Man, there'll be great death everywhere. It'll be a time when the vultures would gather. But he goes on to say, but immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from the sky, the powers of the heaven will be shaken, and the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. And he sent forth his angels with great trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds and from one end of the sky to the other. So when that happens, at the time of the coming of the Son of Man, there's going to be this great cataclysm. This apocalyptic cosmological cataclysm, astronomical. Yeah, that's funny use of that word. Astronomical. The stars are going to fall from the skies. We're going to have meteors and showers and that kind of stuff. It's going to be cataclysmic, he said. So not only is it going to be evident to everybody, but it's going to be a devastating cosmological event. And he says he is going to send out his angels with a great trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from the one end of the sky to another. So at what point do God's people get gathered together and brought to him? At the coming of Christ. Okay, at the coming of Christ. And at what point is the coming of Christ? At the end of the 7 years. We've already heard that so far. We'll get into that more. Okay. Now, in 2 Thessalonians, Paul says this to the Thessalonians. The Thessalonians had been told by some of the newer, better teachers in town, the people who had lots of stuff under the hood, you know, who were slick, and they had been told that the Lord has already come back. He's already returned, and we're now living in the millennial age. That's what they were told. So we should stop looking for the return of the Lord. And Paul says to the Thessalonians, now we request you, brethren, with regard to the coming of the Lord Jesus Christ and our gathering together to him, when the Lord comes together and we are gathered together to him, okay, that you may not be quickly shaken from your composure or be disturbed either by a spirit or a message or a letter as if from us. In other words, somebody faking a letter saying that we wrote this, to the effect that the day of the Lord has come. We do not want you to be deceived by a golden mouth teacher, somebody who's brought a letter that says it's from me, or some new document that's risen up that's supposed, you know, like the Gospel of Mary or Magdalene or whatever. Let no one in any way deceive you, for it will not come unless the apostasy comes first. The man of lawlessness is revealed, the son of destruction, who opposes and exalts himself above every so-called God or object of worship, so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as being God. Okay? So the Son of Man will not come until we have the great apostasy, the great falling away throughout the whole world, the great falling away, And the emergence of the man of lawlessness, the Antichrist, the son of destruction, who opposes and exalts himself above every so-called god or object of worship, so that he takes his seat in the temple and displays himself as being God. Now, the abomination that makes desolate in the end time is the Antichrist putting a statue of himself up and requiring worship. That's what this will be because of this and other things. Do you not remember that while I was still with you, I was telling you these things? I've told you this before, he said. You've heard me say this before. Don't be deceived by somebody coming along and telling you that Christ has already come. Because you're going to know. All this stuff's going to happen. Jesus in the sky, all this kind of stuff. And when he does, the world will be apostate. The world will fall away, and this son of lawlessness will have emerged. He will rule everything, and he will put himself up a statue in the temple and require worship. Okay? Remember, while I was still, I was told these things. And you know what restrains him now, so that in his time he may be revealed. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. So the nature of this Antichrist is already at work among us. Okay? Remember that the Antichrist is fueled and powered by Satan. And all of the insidious yeast of the Antichrist is at work among us. It's going out into the world. It's persuading people that God doesn't exist. It's persuading people that the laws of God are silly. It's persuading people that Christ won't come back. It's persuading people all the things that the Antichrist wants to do. I mean, our world today is just running like lemmings off the cliff. You know, look, we're either right or we're wrong, okay? If we're wrong, it's been nice knowing you, okay? If we're right, then that means that the whole world's going to hell in a handbasket, okay? And they're going like 90 miles an hour. As fast as they can go. And that's what he's talking about. He says that the seeds of the teachings of the Antichrist are permeating the world. The mystery of lawlessness is already at work. And only he who now restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way. Until the Holy Spirit is taken out of the way, that's who restrains the enemy. Until he is taken out of the way, then the Antichrist is going to be hindered. But once he's taken out of the way, then it'll all go to hell in a handbasket. It'll emerge fully. Then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth and bring to an end by the appearance of his coming. So the Lord will slay the Antichrist at his coming, his second coming, and he's going to do it by the breath of his mouth. How was it that the world was created? God spoke it into existence, okay? How was it that all of things that God does were done? They were done through the Word. When Paul said we should put on the armor of the God, what is it he said was our sword? The Word of God. Okay, so God speaking causes life. We were at Psalm 29 last week. Some of you were in here about how God speaks and the deer's calf. How God speaks and it seems like thunder's coming down. So when Jesus comes and speaks to the Antichrist, he'll be destroyed. Now, how many of y'all saw the cult film Dune?
What?
Dune? Some of y'all saw Dune?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You know the weirding way? How was it that the weirding way worked? They were able to speak a weapon. Okay? That's where this comes from. Anyway. This is the one whose coming is in accord with the activity of Satan, with all power and signs and false wonders, with all the deception of wickedness, for those who perished because they did not receive the love of truth so as to be saved. For this reason, God will send upon them a deluding influence, so that they might believe what is false, in order that they all may be judged who did not believe the truth, but took pleasure in wickedness. When we were studying in Romans, first chapter, it says that people who are idolatrous will be given over to depraved minds, to believe what is true is false, and to believe what is false is true. In other words, they will be allowed to believe what they want to believe. And that will deceive them. It's like a helmet of silliness will come over them, so that it will seem that, you know, what was okay for Adam and Eve should be okay for Adam and Steve. It just seems right. It just seems like it ought to be the way it is. I mean, surely it is. We've said so enough times. It must be that way. A lie repeated often enough soon appears to be the truth. Right? Children, 1 John says, it is the last hour, and just as you heard that the Antichrist is coming, even now many Antichrists have arisen. For this we know, that this is the last hour. John says, we can tell that the spirit of Antichrist is at work in our world because of all of the evil that's come up. You need to remember that many of the despots of our own modern age thought of themselves as the Messiah, like Hitler, for instance, whose whole goal was to purify the world and bring it under his holy leadership. And over and over. I mean, you take Pol Pot and, you know, some of those kind of people. They all think they're the golden child, the chosen one, the one who's going to come and make the world great. For this we know that it is the last hour. From this we know that it is the last hour. They went out from us. They were not really of us, for if they had been of us, they would remain with us. But they went out in order they might be shown that they are all not of us. The people who were given the information about God, knew that there was a God, they would have been one of us who believe, but they've gone out from us. They no longer believe what we believe. They've gone out and they've been allowed to go out in order that it might be shown what they are. And so these people have gone out and they have bought into the lie of the Antichrist, he says. And they have began to pursue the kingdom of the Antichrist. In other words, the kingdom of the Antichrist is being set up today and down through history. The kingdom of the Antichrist, is the foundation is being laid. Daniel takes it all the way back to his own time, to the kingdom of Babylon. You can actually go back to the garden to find the foundation of it. So the Antichrist is this, ultimately, it's this being that rules and reigns at the end of time. But down through history, the type of the Antichrist has shown up through all these various people down through history who operate in these ways. They're skillful persuaders. They'll slick you out of your shirt. They're violent. They're brutal. They're ruthless. They're liars. They're deceivers. They get power by stealing it, not by any righteous means. That's the spirit of the Antichrist, and it is that nature of Satan that is common to all of them, and will manifest itself in its highest form, its purest form of evil, at the time of the end in the Antichrist of the end time. Comments. Got that stunned look on your face again. Yes?
Would this suggest then that anyone from the Middle East who is powerful is highly suspect?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. Anyone from the Middle East who's powerful is what?
Who is powerful is highly suspect.
Well, you know, Jesus said this. He said this, and I this has really stuck with me. He said, I tell you these things before they happen so that you know them to be true. In other words, we have enough information to recognize them when they happen so that the elect won't be deceived, but not enough to predict them to be happening. As far as I'm concerned, anybody from anywhere can be the Antichrist. There's a lot of data that suggests it's going to come out of the Roman world, and we'll get into some of that. But I've been wrong before. You see what I'm saying? If I had to go with the preponderance of what the scriptures suggest, I would tell you that it would be a man coming out of the old Roman Empire. And that would preclude somebody from the Middle East. But you know what? I mean, the Jews missed the first coming because they were looking at the data on the second coming. And, you know, I don't want to miss the emergence of the Antichrist because I've got him boxed up and, you know, he has to be an Italian. And the guy, you know, turns out to be from Chicago.
Well, the Roman Empire included, say, today the UK. And I had started to ask this a few minutes ago. I wondered if it really meant physically what was the Roman Empire, or therefore the descendants, which includes most of the people in this room.
Yeah. Well, who knows? We're going to read some more scripture on this. But one of the things it said earlier on is the people of the Romans, the descendants of the Romans, would be where the Antichrist came from. So how does that to be interpreted? I don't know.
Don't you interpret the UK since it was part of the Roman Empire?
Yes.
Therefore,
yeah.
That means it could be any of us in this room.
Could be. I'm looking. The way you know a prophet is not by their prophecies, but by the fruit in their lives. Balaam, for instance, was a very accurate prophet, but he was evil. Elmer Gantry was a very accurate prophet, but he was evil. So the way you judge a prophet is not by whether or not he's really good at telling the future, but by the fruit in his life. You know, Scripture says the gifts and call of God are irrevocable, which means that if God gives us gifts and we use them for evil, we still have the gifts. So the way that you know the Antichrist is not so much by where he comes from, but by what he does. What he's going to be arrogant, deceitful, you know, all these various things, blasphemous. We read earlier, and we'll read again, that he's going to be arrogant enough to want to change times, change the calendar so that it doesn't, you know, during the French Revolution, they made a week into 10 days, you know, that kind of thing. Certainly, in the French Revolution, we see the spirit of Antichrist at work, for instance. Yes?
Well, another indicator from what you were saying is the Antichrist is going to create peace, or what
mm-hmm.
appears to
That's
be
right.
peace on earth.
That's right.
As soon as someone does that, do we just go?
Well, I think that we need to understand that the only thing that will bring real peace on earth is God. So anybody who purports to bring peace on earth in the absence of God is by definition false. Now, it's not that a lot of people haven't tried in a lot of ways, but and some of them have just been naive, but it's by false. So if someone were to bring a... and remember that the peace, in the 7-year peace is actually a false peace. It's not a real true peace. But if anyone were to establish that, then my antenna would be up. It would be up. But once again, every generation since the time of Christ has expected that Jesus would return in their generation, and they're supposed to. We are supposed to live with a soon expectation of the coming of Christ because it motivates us right. We're supposed to live as if the Master could come home at any time, and what will he find his servants doing? Jesus told parable after parable about this. He went away, he comes back. What will he find you doing? Are you going to be throwing the spit wads when the teacher comes back? Or are you going to be at your desk reading your homework? Okay? Which one are you going to be? And so we're meant to live with the constant expectation that the teacher will come back to the classroom. And this moment, Paul thought it was going to happen in his lifetime. Paul said, if I was you, I wouldn't get married because you're going to be too busy doing all this when, you know. Well, and Paul did say, to his credit, I, not the Lord, suggest this.
Right.
Paul, he said, this is not coming from the Lord. This is coming from me. But he made us. Yeah, that's right. He said, you know, if you're going to burn, marry. But if in light of the work of the kingdom and everything that's going to happen, you know, you'd be better off not to be married. So he was expecting it to come back, for the Lord to come back. He also, though, allowed for the fact that he might die before that. Because at one particular point in his ministry, he said, I'm ready to go. He said, to stay and work for you all would be better for you. For me to go and be with the Lord would be better for me. But since you all need me, I'll stay a little longer. But I'm ready to go. Okay? So... you know, with the Antichrist, we're going to get into the fig tree next week. That's the timing issue of this, the whole thing about the fig tree and 1948 and all that sort of thing. We'll get into that next week. But the deal is that it could be that those who were born or alive during the 1948 time frame, that generation will not pass away until the coming of the Antichrist. That has been suggested by the scriptures and by many, many people as a very valid fulfillment of that. Could easily be. Seems likely to me. However, it could be 10,000 years from now. The whole thing could go around again and again and again until we get there. So we study these things because there are moral lessons to us. You know what the moral lesson to all of this is throughout all of this? You know what the lesson, the message of the book of Revelation is? He who endures to the end will be saved.
Say what?
He who endures to the end will be saved. Endure, endure, endure. Build your spiritual muscle so that you can endure. Don't sit back, you know, doing your knitting, waiting for the rescue mission. Build your spiritual muscle so that you can endure. Because when testing comes, if you're weak, you'll fall away. And it's going to cost you. The message of all the apocalyptic, Daniel's message to his people is, don't give up faith in God, endure. That's Daniel's message. In the midst of an evil kingdom saying, listen, this monolithic kingdom who thinks they're so great, they're going to fall. And the one after them is going to fall. And the one after them is going to fall. Now, if I call them by name, I'm dead. But the truth is that, you know, the lion, the winged lion is going to fall. And the deal is that you need to stand. You need to have the kind of ability to stand that my Shack, your Shack, and Winnebago did when he threw them in the fiery furnace. And they said to Nebuchadnezzar, if you throw us into the fiery furnace, our God will rescue us. But if he doesn't, we won't bow down to your statue. Okay? So you need to have that kind of guts. You need to have the kind of guts that says, I won't bow down to you, and if you throw me in the lion's den, I will trust my God. my God will stop the mouths of the lions. But if he doesn't, and I get eaten, you know, I'm going to be okay anyway. That's the kind of message the first six chapters of Daniel gives us. That's the message that the book of Revelation gives us. Endure to the end. Don't worry about this petty any little persecution you're going through with the Roman Empire, you know, where they're crucifying you by the thousands on the roadsides and all this kind of, don't worry about that little stuff. Because at the end it's going to be even worse, but God's going to defeat him too. You see, that's what he's saying. He's saying this persecution that you're going through right now seems like a lot. I mean, you're losing your houses and your lands and your lives and all this kind of stuff, and they're using you for torches to read by at night and all that kind of stuff. These momentary light afflictions, he says, are not to be considered as worth as much, you know, considering the surpassing glory of knowing who Christ is forever. See, that's the message. We're sitting here around here going, okay, I got my chart figured out here now. Let's see, I got this over here, and this is happening here, and what happened this. And we're doing all this kind of stuff, and that's all fine. It's sort of like biblical candy. But the real message of this is what I just said. See, you can save yourself the price of the book. Because all you have to do now is understand that the message of the apocalyptic writings, book of Revelation, book of Daniel, is maintain your relationship with God and trust Him. Because all salvation is based in relationships. And all relationship is based in trust. Okay. And how do I know if I'm trusting the Lord? I'm trusting the Lord because I'm the one who's doing what He told me to do. Okay. To hear and obey are the same word in Hebrew. If you don't obey, you didn't hear. Shema. Shema. To hear and obey are the same word. If someone doesn't obey, they did not hear. The Hebrews understood that you might have heard it with these ears, but it didn't register in your brain, so you didn't really hear. Okay. So we're called to trust God in the midst of these momentary light afflictions. And my God, we live in Alpharetta, Georgia. You know, there are people who have really tough lives. We need to build the muscle. One of the biggest things, and I got to quit. One of the biggest hoaxes that's ever been thrust on religious people is the notion of a pre-trib rapture. The idea that the Lord's going to come back and rescue us from the tribulation. And the reason why it's so evil is not just because it's wrong and people are going to get their chart wrong, which is totally unimportant. It's because people prepare themselves for the rescue mission. You know, they're sitting here preparing themselves to be rescued, which means they're not building any spiritual muscle for the endurance. See, if I teach you that you're going to go through 7 years of tribulation and you better learn how to believe God for your food because you're not going to be able to buy it in stores. You better learn how to trust God for your healing because none of their doctors will treat you. You can't go to their hospitals. You better learn how to trust God for your daily bread because it's not going to be available to you in a normative way. If you don't build those kind of skills now, when it happens, you're either going to have to know the Boy Scout or die. You're going to, and if push comes to shove, your temptation to fall away will be huge. We need to learn how to endure difficulty now, the little difficulty we have, because it could get tough later. And if we start fussing and cussing at God now over the fact that someone took my parking place, or I have a triple bogey, you know, or I got a little cancer, you know, or this or that happened, or I wrecked my car, or I lost my job, what are we going to do when someone faces us with the eternal decision of Christ or no Christ? You know, it's easy to say, well, I would never betray Christ. Peter did. Peter said it. I would never betray you. Biggest, boldest man in the group. Never betray you. Ran like a rabbit. You know what? I don't blame him. I don't blame him. I don't judge Peter. I love Peter. He was the only one who does anything afterwards. The rest of them are sitting around apostling on their butts for 30 years. Sorry. Anyway, so we need to grow up and understand that difficulty is coming. That's Daniel's message. That's John the Revelator's message. It's even Jesus' message. He says, don't be concerned when you hear this or this or this or this, and don't let this or that fool you. This or that fool you. You know, you'll know when I'm coming back. You'll see it. It'll be coming through the skies. Just hang in there during the rest of this stuff. Just endure. He who endures to the end will be saved. That's the maturity of this message. Comments? Other comments?
Great message.
Who's going to pray us out?